Good morning, everyone.
We are reading in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. And we reached the break on page 34, and then we read through the next section up to page 38 at the break. And then we went back to page 34 and we started to look in detail at this new section. Sri Aurobindo has described to us some of the wonderful, subtle and spiritual experiences that are coming to King Asvapati as the result of his inner growth. Some of them very, very high experiences. But at the beginning of this section, he tells us that only a while at first, these heavenlier states, these large, wide-poised upliftings could endure. They came and they went. And then he explains to us why this happens. Perhaps we can reread these lines. Ravi, would you start? Page 34, line 439, just after the break.
Only a while at first, these heavenlier states, these large wide poised upliftings could endure. The hard and luminous tension breaks through soon. The body's stone, stillness, and the light host trance, the breathless mind and calm of silent mind, or slowly they fail, as saves a golden day. The restless nether members tire of peace, or nostalgia of old little worlds and joys call back some familiar selves to trade the accustomed and inferior way. The need to raise inner natural force of fall, as a child who longs to work can work not long, replace the titan will forever to climb on the heart's altar deep the sacred fire, and old pool of subconscious course renews. It draws the unwilling spirit from the heights, or a dull gravitation drags us down to the blind driven inertia of our base. This tool the supreme diplomat can use. He makes our fall a means for greater right.
Thank you. Anybody has anything they would like to ask about these lines? Then we can read on. Now Sri Aurobindo will explain how the supreme diplomat makes this falling, makes use of it for our progress, how he makes use of our fall from those higher states to help us rise even higher. Bessie, would you read? Line 457.
Amid the tumults of the sun.
Thank you. So when we fall from that our being that we may have reached in concentration, in silence, the supreme diplomat, the Lord, makes our fall, our coming back to our normal human self, he makes that into a means, a way to help us to rise higher, because when we come back into this ignorant nature's gusty field, this field where we are blown about by gusts of this and that, different kinds of impulses, when we come back into this half-ordered chaos of mortal life, then that formless power, that self of eternal light, which is high above, they follow. They come down with us. They follow as our spirit descends from the heights back to our natural level. They follow the twin duality, the consciousness and the power, the self and the power. They are forever one, forever connected. That twin duality chooses to live here in the tumults of the sense, here in this world where we are dominated by sense impressions of all kinds, disturbing and stirring us up. Amid that stormy field of sense impressions, he, the supreme diplomat, comes. He comes unseen into our darker parts, the lower parts that are not so conscious, and curtained by the darkness, does his work. From there, he's working on us as a subtle and all-knowing guest living within us and guiding us from within without us even noticing it. He goes on doing that till they too, the darker parts, feel the need and the will to change. They will only change when they feel the need to change and the will to change. Otherwise, they will just cling on to their gusty nature. And this is necessary because everything here must learn to obey a higher law. This is the evolutionary process. A part of us reaches a higher level, may even get established firmly there, but then it has to turn back to the lower levels and lift them up. This is what happens at every step and stage of the evolutionary process. So even the cells of our body must learn to obey that higher law. They must learn to contain within them the flame of an immortal being. That will make the transformation of all the other parts much easier. If the body's cells, if the most material, physical part of us feels the need and will to change, and if it becomes able to hold the immortal's flame, that will be a great step forward. If that didn't happen, otherwise the spirit alone would reach its source, leaving a half-saved world to its dubious fate. Many highly developed beings, great souls, they have done this. They've reached their source and they've merged into their source and they've left this world very much as it was, without change. So Sri Aurobindo says, that's a pity that those who have this great capacity, these possibilities, these realizations, if they would concentrate on this, on helping everything here to learn to obey a higher law, then there would be a possibility for the world to change. Otherwise, this half-saved world will just go on much as it is, to its dubious fate, its doubtful fate. We can't see what would happen. Nature would go on laboring and striving, unsaved, unredeemed. And our Earth will just go on spinning, unhelped, in space. And the purpose of this immense creation, this material universe, will fail, or would fail, no? Until then, of course, if the purpose fails and if there's no possibility of change, then the frustrate universe will just sink, dissolve, undone, unmade. Yes.
Among all the three principles that we have, the mind, vital, and body, I think mind is the one which cooperates first to be changed.
I think Sri Aurobindo tells us that there's two influences helping us to change. One is this pressure from above, and one is the response of the inner being in us, the subtle parts, inner life body, what we call the subliminal, which has a contact with the subtle worlds where things are not so weighed down by matter. So there's this double pressure from above and from below. And depending on the person, different parts of our being may respond. No? But the advantage of the mind, if that gets in contact with this double movement, with its all faster inner self, is that there's this possibility of conscious collaboration. And that's what's there in King Asvapati. But you can see from what he writes that this possibility of the rising up of the spirit, the awakening of the soul, these are really the parts that lead the being.
Then the external mind follows, or it gets transformed?
Yeah, the heart gets touched. Something in the body may get touched. If the body starts to respond, then this heaviness of inertia can be diminished. And the inner mind can perhaps come forward and refine our usual ordinary, Mother says, our dull, usual, ordinary way of being, for which we are so attached to, so used to.
Yeah. No. Is this awakening of the mind, is that equivalent to breaking of the veil? Sri Aurobindo mentions this essential mark or progress in the southern.
Yes. I think there can be a mental awakening before that real breaking of the veil, in which the barrier, this heavy curtain of the flesh, gets lifted, and there's a conscious communion between the subtler parts and the outer parts. And if I have understood correctly, he says this comes about by a growth of the inner being under these two influences, the influence from above and the influence from deep within. And if once something central in our being feels that, oh yes, this is the only thing worth living for, then that movement, which Sri Aurobindo calls the movement of consecration, happens. And that seems to be a very crucial moment, when there's a central part of the being which says only this is important. So depending on people, some people are more mental, and some people act more spontaneously from the heart center. And Mother seems to say that actually the people who are very much centered in their body may be in closer contact with the psychic being, that there's possibility of a close contact. But whatever can be done to awaken any part of the being is helpful. Can you speak a little louder?
Yeah. When you said it's a pressure from above, and it's respond from the subliminal.
I think this is how Sri Aurobindo has spoken about it. This subliminal, it's the part of us, the inner mind, heart, life, body parts that are more subtle and we say below the threshold of our normal waking consciousness. That's what subliminal means.
Yeah, but you say subliminal subliminal.
Maybe I said subliminal being, perhaps. I said. And as that grows, you know, as the consciousness grows there, then this breaking of the veil may happen. I think I have understood correctly. Yes.
In the fire-like, in the top of the static fire, he says that he comes unseen into our darker parts. Contained by the darkness, that is the word.
Yes.
That means awakening of this subliminal is also done by him.
By him, exactly, yes. He's working there in the darkness, and we don't notice at first. And we will see now with him. With Asvapati, what happens? It's very well described in these next lines, what I hope we'll read today. But here he's explained to us why this coming down process is necessary. No? Because everything here has to learn to change. Just having wonderful experiences up on our higher levels of consciousness and not having any connection with the lower being. That's not quite good enough to fulfill the purpose of this immense creation. Would you read?
Even his godlike strength to Christ must fall, his greater consciousness withdrew behind, being and eclipsed his human outside stone, feel again the old sublimities, being the high, saving touch.
Thank you. So Asvapati is a very highly developed being. Sri Aurobindo speaks of his godlike strength. But even in him, this process had to happen. No? Even his godlike strength to rise must fall. And so his greater consciousness withdrew behind. He's no longer aware of it. And his human outside feels dim and eclipsed, like when a shadow falls across the sun or the moon. And then there's an effort on the part of the human outside. There's an effort of aspiration. His human outside strove, it made an effort to feel again those old sublimities that he has experienced. It wants to bring back into itself that high, saving touch, that ethereal flame, that flame from the very highest levels of substance. It tries to call back. It has a sense of dire need, and it wants to call back to it the divine force. And in response to that aspiration and effort, always the power poured back like sudden rain, or it might be that slowly in his breast a presence grew like a sun dawning. His consciousness, his human outside, can clamber back, means climbing with difficulty, clambering back to some remembered height. Or like a bird, it can fly up, soar up high above that summit it had reached from which it had fallen. Each time he rose, there was a larger poise. A poise is when you are balanced in a position that you can keep, can maintain for some time. He's able to dwell, to remain on a higher spirit plane, the light of divine consciousness, remained in him for a longer time. So this rising and falling is an oscillation. Usually we think of an oscillation of a pendulum swinging from one side to the other, but this is an oscillation between earth and heaven, up and down, up and down. So this up and down movement, this oscillation between earth and heaven, he says it's like an ineffable communion's climb. There's a gradual climbing of a communion, a communication between earth and heaven, which can't be put into words. It's something so wonderful. Through this process, there grew in him, as grows a waxing moon, the glory of the integer of his soul. So it's as if the soul starts out as a tiny little thin crescent, and through this oscillation, this up and down, it grows more and more and more until it's completely full, the glorious full moon of his soul.
What is an integer?
An integer is a whole, something complete.
Waxing moon?
Sorry?
Waxing moon?
Yes, we say that the moon waxes and wanes. It grows bigger and then it becomes smaller. So the waxing moon is the growing moon. And the waning moon is when it's... We see less and less of it every day. So to wax means to grow. So as a result of that growth of the integer of the soul, certain things happen. Will you read, Lorraine?
Why? on time's unrest, faced all experience with unaltered peace.
Thank you. So there's this growing towards the wholeness of the soul, the integer, the full development of the soul. And there's this ineffable communion, this communication between the higher and the lower. So he experiences a union of the real, with a capital R, a supreme reality, with the unique. I think this means the uniqueness of every individual soul. He sees the connection between the two, this union between the real and the real expressed in his many, many unique forms. He experiences a gaze of the alone, of the one without a second, the soul. He sees that one gazing through every face, not only human faces, animal faces, flower faces, all the faces in the creation. And he experiences the presence of the eternal, the transcendent, who is beyond time, the state beyond time. He can experience that presence of the eternal in the hours, in the passage of human time. So these experiences have the effect of widening our mortal mind that is dependent on a physical brain and sees things only through the veil of the ignorance. This mortal mind's half look on things gets widened. And the gap between man's force, our human capacities and strength, and fate, the determinisms of the universe, perhaps we can say, the things that are fixed, that we can't control or alter. These together made whole, completed, the fragment being which we human beings, we are here. We are fragment beings. We're just little bits of the whole. And we are fragmented in ourselves. We have many, many different fragments. So through these experiences in Asvapati, all this gets made whole, complete and harmonized, so that at last he's able to maintain a firm spiritual poise. This oscillation, this up and down, is no longer needed. He's able, in his central consciousness, to remain constantly lodged in the eternal's realm. He's able to feel secure in the silence and the ray of higher consciousness. He won't have to drop back down again. He feels a settlement in the immutable, that which does not change, the permanence. It seems that this state of permanence is perhaps one of the aims of the Buddha, that which doesn't change, that which is constantly viable, perfect, permanent, the immutable. So the higher parts of his being, they live high up in the silent self. His mind could rest on that higher ground and look down to the manifestation, which Sri Aurobindo describes so beautifully. The manifestation, if you see it from above, the magic and the play, where the God child lies on the lap of night and dawn. Night and dawn, the twin goddesses who give birth to the divine child. The dualities, we can say, that nourish the growth of the divine evolving in the universe. This magic and play where the everlasting puts on time's disguise, disguises himself in the form of the moments and all the happenings of the moments, and all of us who live in time disguises us beautifully as all these many beings. So Aswapati is able, his spirit has become equal, firmly poised, settled in the immutable. He's able to give his vast assent, to say yes, not only to those silent heights, but also to the troubled depths here, and say, yes, it has a meaning, it has a purpose. So he reaches this wonderful state of poised serenity, of tranquil strength, a wide, unshaken look on time's unrest, faced all experience with unaltered peace.
What is the meaning of unaltered?
It doesn't change. The peace doesn't change. Nothing disturbs that peace. His look, he can look on everything, and his look doesn't get shaken. He's not shocked or troubled by anything that he sees. All this unrest of time, he is able to look at it and see that all this play, it's part of the play of the godchild.
In other words, his mind could rest, that also.
Yes, this is his mind. Because of the spirit's poise, the mind can become quiet. Mm-hmm. Shall we go on? Amitoj, you'll read.
Indifferent to the sorrow and delight, untempted by the marvel and the fall, immobile, it beheld the flux of things. Calm and apart, supported all doubters. His spirit stillness helped the toiling world. Inspired by silence and the closed eyes sad, his face did work with the new luminous arm. On the crude material from which all is made, and the refusal of inertia's mouth, and the great front of the world's ignorance, and nation matter, and the huge error of life. As a sculptor chisels a deity out of stone, he slowly chipped off the dark and lower line of defense of nature's ignorance, the illusion of the incarnation, in whose black form the eternal wraps his head, that he may act unknown in cosmic time. A splendor of self-creation from the peace, a transfiguration in the mystic depths, a happier cosmic working would begin, and fashion the world shape in his anew. God found in nature, nature fulfilled in God.
Thank you. These are the results of that firm spiritual poise which he has achieved. So he's able to give this vast assent, to say yes, with unaltered peace. So he isn't troubled by the sorrow, he's not attracted by the delight, he's not tempted by the marvel, the call, all the attractions. His spirit is immobile, watching, beheld, seeing the flux, the flow of things, everything that's moving in this moving universe. And the stillness of his spirit is supporting, because he's saying yes, it's supporting all the efforts of the toiling world. But he is guided to do something, to do some work. He's inspired by the higher silence and the sight of the closed eyes, the subtle sight that has been granted to him. He's able to use his force, his godlike strength, to work with a new luminous art. It's more full of light, of consciousness. He's able to work on the crude material from which everything is made, on all this matter, all this. This refusal of inertia's mass. The quality, one of the main qualities of matter is inertia. No, it doesn't move by itself. That's on the physical level. And on the vital and mental level, there's grey front of the world's ignorance. And there's nescient matter, matter which has no knowledge. And the huge error of life, life that in this state of ignorance cannot help but err because of the imperfection of the level of universal consciousness at the moment. He's able to work on all those obstacles. Shobindo describes him like a sculptor who sees the possibility of an image in a stone and has to slowly chip away until he can reveal that deity that he has seen. This dark envelope that's covering the soul. This dark envelope, which he says is the line of defense of nature's ignorance, the resistance that clings on to the present state. And he's able to work on also the illusion and mystery of the inconscient. He says that the eternal wraps his head, covers himself up in this black pall, this thick, heavy, dark cloth of inconscience, so that he can work unknown in cosmic time, in universal time. We don't see what he's doing. He's doing it all from behind the veil, unknown. But as he does this work of chipping off, then a splendor of self-creation from the peaks, coming from the higher levels of consciousness, there's a shaping of splendid self-creation. And from the mystic depths, or in the mystic depths, there's a transfiguration. This word transfiguration has a special connotation. Of course, it's like transmutation or transformation, but especially it means giving to things their divine shape, their true divine shape. So in this way, a happier cosmic working, universal working, could begin, and it could fashion, it could shape the world shape in him, in Asvapati, anew. It means that this figure of a human being is getting changed in all its aspects. The result is to be God found, discovered in nature, and nature fulfilled in God. He's doing this, I think, in his individual self. This is the work of the spiritualized individual, to act on cosmic nature through himself as a representative. Shall we go on, Sudhanya?
Only life's lower reaches.
Thank you. Argosies, Argosies. Yes, they are, or they were, sailing merchant ships carrying luxury goods, treasures. Argos, an Argosy. It's from the, I don't know, 15th or 16th century. These wonderful sailing ships used to set out from the city of Ragusa on the Italian coast, I believe. No, Croatian coast, yeah.
Dubrovnik.
From Dubrovnik. Ragusa is Dubrovnik? Okay, there you are.
Yeah. Maybe it's been to the quest of Jason with the Argonauts. Yeah. And their ship was called Argos.
Their ship was called the Argo, exactly. Yeah, Argos.
Clear, minus, white, light.
Also, that's nice. That meaning is there in the word also. Yes, thank you. The ambiguous, cowled, celestial puissance worked. Yes. Cowled means the head is covered. So we were told, no, that the Lord covers his head in a dark pall. Yes. He's curtained by the darkness. So that heavenly power, celestial puissance, that heavenly power, which is cowled, hidden, and therefore ambiguous. We can't understand what its meaning and significance is. It is working even in the lower reaches of life, the lower levels, because there in the darkness, something has to change too. So the work is going on, and that work is being watched. Asvapati's witness consciousness watches all that working going on in moveless peace. So as a result of that working of the cowled celestial puissance, even on the struggling nature left below, the lower reaches that remained dim, strong periods of illumination are coming, powerful experiences. So he describes these. Some come like lightnings, lightnings of glory, flashes of lightning burned. Experience can become a tale, an adventure story of blaze and fire. And through the air, through the atmosphere are coming to him these vessels, these argosies, bringing gifts, precious gifts from the gods, bringing strange riches from the unseen. So as a result of that, when the thought becomes silent and blank, splendors of insight would fill it. Those inconscient stillnesses of the lower nature, knowledge spoke to them, and rivers of energy, higher energy, pour down, rivers of bliss and luminous force, visits of beauty, storm sweeps of delight coming like a cyclone. So intense and powerful. All these things rain down from the all-powerful mystery above. So we'll read one more passage. Mila. Hmm. Thank you. So all these wonderful experiences have been raining down from the all-powerful mystery above, and also from there, thence, it means from there, stooped the eagles of omniscience. Powerful birds coming down. I've mentioned this word stoop before because it comes quite often in the poem, but just recently I learned that this is actually the official word for what a bird of prey does when it sees from the sky. It sees its prey, it closes its wings and heads straight down at a great speed, a tremendous speed. There's one, the peregrine falcon, they think that maybe it's the fastest moving animal in the world. It reaches 200 miles an hour as it stoops. So it's something like that, something extremely powerful, beautiful golden eagles coming down, and that coming down of the omniscience, it rends, it tears apart a dense veil, the veil perhaps that you were speaking about. So the veil is rent and he hears a whisper, but it's a very, very powerful whisper. These are eagles of all knowledge, omniscience. So that mighty whisper gets repeated in the privacy of his soul. And it takes the form of a wisdom cry from rapt transcendences, states beyond the manifestation, trance-like states, sang on the mountains of an unseen world. He hears that cry bringing knowledge. And there are the voices that an inner listening hears, that the subtle ear hears, conveyed to him their prophet utterances, telling how things really are and about the future also. He experiences flame-wrapped outbursts, as if there's a sudden burst of flame, expressions of the immortal word of creation, and flashes of an occult revealing light, a light that reveals secrets, came near to him from that unreachable secrecy, that all-powerful mystery above. And within him, he experiences an inspired knowledge sitting enthroned within himself, who seconds can give flashes, short flashes of illumination that show much more than years and years and years of reasoning. An ictus of revealing luster fell as if a pointing accent upon truth. Can you say anything about this word ictus, Claude? No.
Could you tell us what the word
omniscience, all knowledge. Science is knowledge. And so we have omniscience. There's omnipotence, all power. No. Omnipresence, present everywhere. Mm. Please read what it says about ictus.
A Latin derivative meaning and blow, strike, or thrust. In poetic usage, it indicates the pulse or stress of a verse's rhythm or meter. Fiorabindo may here be carrying over the sense of the Latin phrase ictus sois, meaning a stroke of the sun.
Sunstroke. Yes. So I think there's a double suggestion. If I'm not wrong, the ictus, the stress in a line of poem or on a word, in a word, you want to show that this syllable has to be stressed. It has a particular form, a triangular form pointing downwards. And that's perhaps reflecting this this ray of sunlight. So it's light and pressure, a revealing ictus. Something points out to you. This revealing luster fell as if a pointing accent upon truth. Look, this is what you have to stress or notice. And the other thing is suddenly like a sky flare, a rocket going up that lights up all the dark ground below, a swift intuitive discernment shone. Discernment is often imaged as a sword that can make distinctions, but it's also the power of seeing clearly, discernment. So from that inner knowledge, one glance could separate the true and false. To the mind, they may be indistinguishable, but this intuitive discernment can show at once. It could raise its rapid torch fire in the dark, in this darkness of the subconscious, perhaps, to check the claimants crowding through mind's gates. That's this image again of mind as a marketplace or a factory. You know, there's all kinds of things pressing to get in. What are you going to allow in? If there's that discernment, you can check all those people who are claiming the right to enter, those thoughts, ideas. They've even got false passports, which he speaks about elsewhere. They are covered by the forged signatures of the gods. They seem to have a divine sanction, but they don't all really. No? And just as in a fairy tale, the discernment gives the power to detect the magic bride in her disguise, even if she looks like a poor beggar girl. We can see that, oh, this is the one, and can scan the apparent face of thought and life. See what is the real significance of what is going on. This faculty of discernment is extremely important.
The bride is...
You could say perhaps the divine partner. But with this line, I think about the fairy tale, you know, the princess comes, but there she is, she's in rags, and only the discernment can see who she really is. I think we'll stop there for today.
Thanks to Shrivindra.